Hi, my name's Jonathan Harden. Welcome back to In Anything at the Minute, the Honest Actors Podcast. This is episode number 10. We are in double figures, which in itself is cause for some kind of minor celebration. But if you haven't heard episode 9, and if you haven't, I don't know why, but if you haven't heard episode 9 with Emily Taff, you won't know that the Honest Actors blog is up in two categories in this year's UK Blog Awards. So we're up in Arts and Culture and in Vlogger and Podcast. It's a public vote to get down to the shortlist, so please go to the website www.inanything.com and click on the blue Vote Now button that appears at the top of every page. If you voted already, you should feel virtuous. Thank you very much. I really do appreciate it. But you can still do more. You can, in fact, vote once every single day. So if you voted once, twice, three, four, 10 times already, you can still vote. There's 1 week left of the vote. It finishes today week on the 25th of January. So the more votes we can get before then, the better. I'd like to make the shortlist in at least one of those categories. I don't expect to win one, but it would be really nice, given that it's the first year, just to make one of those shortlists. So please do all you can to help us get there. Go to the website inanything.com and click on the blue Vote Now button at the top of every page. That's it from me in terms of an introduction. Stick around at the end of this episode and there'll be a little teaser for an interview with me on another podcast for actors called Acting Inspired with Lewis Goody. But for now, this is episode 10 of the Honest Actors Podcast with Michael Hadley. Enjoy.
First thing to say though is thanks very much on the record for giving your time up on what is supposedly the hottest day
is it?
Of the year so far.
Bloody hell, so, it felt like it coming through the Queen's speech area.
The first question is, how did you get into acting? How did you come to be an actor?
It depends how far back you want to go. I mean, the first thing I can remember was at primary school, playing in what was sort of the school pantomime, I suppose, and playing a landlord, playing a nasty character who came stamping on the stage, demanding rent. And the girl who was playing the cottage keeper forgot her line. So I came on prematurely, much to everyone's surprise, stamped on stage and demanded in a very loud voice, "You owe me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks rent." And this brought the house down. So there was the instant sort of reaction to what I'd done. So I was must have been kind of bitten then. Then there's a gap until my final year at secondary school, at grammar school, Lichfield Grammar School, and I played Henry V. And again, it was that thing of walking down at the end, you know, getting all this rapturous applause and thinking, well, this is quite nice, I can do this. My real ambition in life was to be a professional cricketer, but I wasn't good enough. I wasn't good enough to be what I really wanted to be. So I came into acting by default, really.
It was your second string.
As my second string.
And just to kind of unpack a little bit, there's a big gap there between Give Me the Rent and Henry V.
Yeah.
Does it just cease to exist to you then during that time? Or is it always, are you the kind of kid that dresses up, that does voices, impersonates teachers?
No, I did a bit of impersonating, you know, at Christmas parties and what have you, I suppose, showing off. But I did actually do one other play, which was Murder in the Cathedral, and I played the third knight and third tempter. And then the following year, and that was the penultimate year of being at secondary school. So yeah, there was a gap, but then there was lots of other stuff happening, you know. I was at boarding school, so there was a lot of getting used to
being away.
Being away, exactly.
So you come down then after Henry V, you get this rapturous applause, or at least what you remember now is rapturous applause.
Yes.
What happens then? How do you turn that surprise and glee at the response into something practical? What do you do with
that? And something slightly more worthwhile than just getting your ego massaged, yeah. My English master, really, and my dad, I suppose. My dad saw an advert for the National Youth Theatre in the Daily Mail. How those two coexisted, I will never, ever understand, but they did. And a combination of my father and my English master got me an audition with the National Youth Theatre. And also, my English master's daughter was then doing a stage management course, I think at RADA, maybe RADA or Lambda. And she gave me a list of drama schools to apply to. And I got into the youth theatre. And on the final audition weekend, most of the drama schools had stopped auditioning by the time it had occurred to me. So on the final audition weekend at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, somebody withdrew and I replaced them and got in. So that was it. I mean, fate had decided what my fate was.
So I'm going to skip over training, at least as an experience in itself. It may come back to how you feel about it retrospectively. But when you come out of training at Bristol Old Vic, do you feel like you're an actor, you're ready, good to go?
I came out of the Old Vic school and immediately joined the Old Vic company. They took, I forget how many, they took, I think they took three men and two women, something like that, from the Old Vic school. So it was heavily biased in favor of people joining from the Old Vic school as opposed to any other drama school. So I was helped a bit by that.
How long were you in that company for?
A year. And then, I mean, you know, we're going back a bit. So there was a repertory system then. So I was with the Old Vic company for a year and then went off and joined the Belgrade Theatre, Coventry. And I was there for a year and then I went to Birmingham. The studio company was just starting in the new theatre there. And I was there for 2 years. So there was kind of continuous employment. So, you know, I was, yeah, definitely, I was an actor.
4 years of rep as well, I suppose, is continued training.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
So when you come out of rep into the big bad world of whatever follows.
Well, of course, it doesn't, you don't come out, you know, you come out, you might come out, you might do a television, you know, or film or what have you in between those stints in rep. I mean, they didn't follow on absolutely, you know, one after another. There were various sort of expeditions into other areas.
But your expectations at that point must have been that that would pretty much continue, that you'd established yourself as, at least internally to yourself, as a working actor.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have any recollection of the first time you might have thought that a career might be more difficult than that?
The first time being out of work, you mean?
Yeah.
I suppose it had a certain novelty. I mean, you know, I did, I was lucky in that my brother, elder brother, was sharing a flat, first of all in Clapham and then in Wimbledon with various friends of his. And there was always seemed to be a little box room that nobody wanted. So I was an extra person helping to pay the rent. And they didn't demand much rent off me. So I had various jobs working in pubs and car parks and, you know, whatever, to earn enough just to pay for that and to pay for my beer. So I think the first time I was out of work for any length of time, I associate with putting on about 2 stone in weight, all down to the Guinness that I was consuming.
So you're living in and around South London with your younger, older brother?
Older brother.
Older brother. What does he do? What's his kind of career path in comparison?
He's a civil engineer. He was a civil engineer.
And his flatmates similarly?
Were civil engineers, yeah.
And what did they make of this box room inhabitant?
Oh, I think they were fascinated to have somebody who, you know, and I brought people back who were pretty sort of wild. And I remember at one point we had a guy who was working at the Foreign Office. He was Irish, actually, but was very, very absolutely straight down the line, terrified of anything sort of happening that would damage his career. And of course, you know, inevitably he came back one night and there was a group of actors smoking pot, completely off our heads, playing very, very loud music. And he was absolutely terrified that this was going to get reported and he would lose his job in the Foreign Office. And, you know, so it had its ups and downs.
But, you know, do you think there was a certain sex appeal to having...
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So you've mentioned already, you've hinted at kind of a few things you've done. What I'm not asking you to rhyme them all off, but what are the kinds of things over the years that you find yourself doing when not able to find acting work?
Well, that's it really. I can remember working in pubs and car parks, NCP car parks in Olympia, which consisted of taking the... I could never understand how people were so compliant. You took the keys off them so that you could repark their cars in an orderly fashion. And with very few exceptions, people handed over the keys to Aston Martins, Lamborghinis.
It was the impressive NCP uniform that
did
it.
It was just extraordinary to let this bunch of harum scarums drive these cars around multi-story car parks. Anyway, I digress. What else did I do? I did some sort of youth drama with young theatre groups. I did some of that and got a bit of money for that. But by and large, that's about it until we started having a family. And then my wife, who's a graduate, an English graduate, took a nursing course. And I'm sure this is looking back with rose-tinted spectacles, but I always remember it as being a period when, as the children, got four children. So as the children came along, I seemed to be out of work at just the right time, i.e. Sue would be at home and I would be off touring with Cambridge Theatre Company or Oxford Players or whatever the company was, and she would be at home for about the first 2 years. And then, miraculously, the work would dry up, Sue would go to work as a nurse, and I would be the, what do they call, the house person.
House person, stay-at-home dad.
I was the stay-at-home dad. And I'm sure it wasn't as neat and as I'm making it sound. You know, there were variants on that. But yeah, that's kind of how it worked. So there wasn't the need to get out. I mean, you did get unemployment benefit. And
so that was basically when it stopped, was whenever you started to have a family.
Yeah.
Do you think those experiences outside of acting, do you think they're important? Do you think they, or are they just a kind of a necessary evil that if you could at all avoid, if you could go back and avoid, you would?
I don't think you can avoid things. No, they're neither good nor bad. I mean, it's what happens. I certainly wouldn't be somebody to lay down the law and say, look, I suppose I would say to do something is better than doing nothing. I mean, doing nothing is soul destroying. So, and, you know, the family thing is ultimately the most rewarding thing you can, well, in my book, is the most rewarding thing you can do. You know, it's just so fascinating. It's a bloody hard work and you don't sleep much and all of that. But it's there, it has to be done. And yeah, it's just very, very enjoyable.
And in terms of being a father then and being an actor, obviously, you can't really speak for not being an actor, but do you think being an actor created any issues as the kids got older? Did they understand the kind of in and out of work thing in comparison to what their friends' parents did? Were you ever aware of them struggling to comprehend what it was that dad did?
I think it's very hard to be objective about it now, to look, you know, to look back and see things in sort of neat formations. It's much more subjective. I think they were fascinated by it. I mean, because, you know, I read to them copiously, books and so on, and entertained them. So they regarded me as this sort of entertainment figure, which is what I was. They've all had a go at youth theatre. None of them are actors, but they've all had a go.
And is that a source of pleasure or displeasure, or are you kind of ambivalent to it? It was just, that's how it worked.
That's how it worked. They had a go at it. It didn't suit them. My daughter was the only one who could, three boys and a girl, and she's just got a facility, certainly for Shakespeare and for acting in general. So she could have been. But when it came to the crunch, you know, it was that thing. I certainly wouldn't have stopped her, but it was definitely a question of, it's got to be the thing you most want to do in your life. And she, on her own admission, is not somebody who takes rejection easily. And if you can't take rejection, then don't be an actor.
So do you think taking rejection is the hardest thing?
Yeah.
Has it gotten any easier with time?
Yeah, I suppose, yes, it has. It has. I mean, it depends. It depends very much on the job. If it's something you desperately want, you know, and you feel you've made a really good fist of it, and then you get rejected, that's, you know, you get rejected all the time for sort of, you know, bits and pieces of work that you do, or maybe very lucrative adverts you get rejected, but you can't take those seriously, because as you're told time and time again, as soon as you walk in, you know, they've decided. So you can't take that seriously. But if you're rejected for something you really want and you feel you've made a really good fist of, then that's still hard, yeah.
What's the longest, what's your longest run of rejections is a way of asking to memory. What's the longest you can recall being out of work?
I kind of have to rely on my wife to tell me this because you don't sort of add it up or count it out. You suddenly look, but you know, she will say, do you realize, or she would have said, do you realize you've been out now for 6 months? Have I? And it, you know, there's so much other stuff to do that you kind of haven't noticed. You know, it's not biting away. It's never bitten away at me to that degree. I'm sure I'm being a bit over-optimistic about my past, and there have been times when it does get incredibly depressing. But I can't remember it sort of completely taking over my life. I've always sort of felt, you know, it's your duty. You're lucky enough to live somewhere where you can you're lucky enough to be doing something that you really want to do. And part of the sacrifice you have to make is the fact that you're not always going to be employed. So just get on with the rest of your life, you know.
And did you find, certainly having the diversion of family, the important diversion of family, did you think that made it a little bit easier not to get too bogged down in yourself and your career?
Yeah, definitely. Because you have to give so much. You can't always, you know, being an actor, it's all me, 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 me. Not all me, but you know what I mean, you know. And the fact that there are sort of one, two, three, four other people around, all demanding attention, all being equally important in their own eyes, is a great leveller.
And once they leave, this is kind of probably the first time I've asked this question, actually, because I haven't spoken to many people who've had kids, let alone who've had kids who've got up and it sounds like they're all out of the house.
Left the nest.
Yeah. Left the nest.
Yep.
Did you find even for a time after that, that the me starts to possibly creep back into it? Or had you trained yourself out of it by that point?
I don't know, because you still, even if they're not in the nest, you're still thinking of them all the time, and there is still stuff going on, there's interaction, one of them lives nearby. I guess it's a hard one to answer that, Jonathan. I guess I'm in that sort of state now. I mean, you know, I haven't worked for about 3 months. But there still seems plenty. No, I guess once you've sort of, as you said, trained yourself, once you've got used to that thing of turning to other things. I mean, you know, I've edited a book called Lifting the Latch, which is about a shepherd and carter called Montabit. And I did a one-man show in Charlbury in Oxfordshire, which is where I live in the Cotswolds. So there are other things that I would turn to. I'm doing a thing with the local beer festival now based on Magna Carta. So the creative part of me still, you know, demands to be exercised.
Interrupting Michael and interrupting myself, not for the first time, to remind listeners that there will be a Honest Actors little seminar and Q&A at this year's Surviving Actors, which takes place in February. You can find out more about that and book your place on www.survivingactors.com. Delighted to be part of it this year. Hopefully you can join us. Like I say, you need to book in advance, and you can do that on their website, survivingactors.com. That's all I gotta say. Except maybe vote. You know what I'm talking about. Back to Michael.
In a context of people who aren't all actors and jazz musicians, do you find yourself looking at others' lifestyles? And I'm hinting at kind of that notion at some stage people retire. Do you look at retirees and think, oh, I'd love to do that? Or do you think, thank God?
thank God I've still got something else that I want to do. I want to carry on until I no longer have the facility to learn the lines or until something else happens.
And do you think you'll ever want to buy out?
I can't imagine. It's weird, isn't it? Once you've done something for so long, I just can't. Yeah, what would take its place? And the buzz you get from working with, I mean, one of the greatest joys of, we haven't talked much about the philosophy of being an actor or anything like that, and I don't want to get too grand about it, but I mean, the fact that you're with a company of people, and this is mainly stage work, where you get together with a company and you rehearse for 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever weeks, you're with that little family. And the great thing about it is I'm 67 now, but I'll be working with people who are 18, 19, you know, and you're all equal. There's no hierarchy, or you can't let hierarchies creep in because you've got to be honest, you've got to be open and all those things. And it's just brilliant. It's just a brilliant lifestyle. And where else do you get that, you know, other than with your own family, which sort of grows up and around you? But I'd miss that.
Have you always enjoyed that? I mean, you also have a huge kind of list of people you've worked with over the years. Do you find they come in and out of your life, or have you made a special effort to keep in touch with a lot of them?
I think you do initially, and then just the sheer numbers, and with especially when you've got children and they've got their friends, and you know, you move into a different sort of milieu, I guess I'm not very good at sort of staying in touch. I've loved so many people that I've worked with, you know. There's a list as long as this table of people who, yeah, I'd love to have seen again. And sometimes you do hit it off with someone and you go on seeing them for a bit, but I don't know.
It would be impossible, wouldn't it?
It would be impossible.
So all that said, the fact that you love it and you can't imagine giving it up. I'm implying that you love it, you know, you've said about as much.
Yeah.
Have there been any points, when your wife, you know, taps you on the shoulder and says, you know, you've been out for 6 months, have you at any point considered giving up?
Yes.
On numerous occasions?
No, seriously, only on one occasion.
And what brought that about?
Do you know, I can't remember. It must have been a period out of work and just, you know, just going up for things and not getting them. A pattern like, the pattern of rejection was becoming too regular and eating away at confidence.
And do you remember what age you were when this occurred?
I guess it would be in my 40s. Why it should happen then, I've no real understanding.
And would it be fair to say you're glad then that you didn't give in to those?
Oh, bloody hell, yes. Absolutely.
And how close do you think you came to walking away?
Well, again, it's one of those things that, you know, I'm sure at the time I felt that I was absolutely going to do it. Looking back now, it doesn't feel like, you know, really the there was a serious possibility that I was going to do it.
So what would you have done? Do you know what you would have done? Have you always had a kind of, if I wasn't an actor, I would be whatever? Have you always had something in mind that you might like to explore?
No, but I'll tell you one thing. When I was sort of, before the sort of the drama school thing came up, and we had a career advisor at school, Mr. Adams, who was a lovely bloke, but spectacularly useless at sort of career things. He thrust under my nose because he knew how fond I was of any sort of games, you know, tennis, swimming, rugby, football, cricket, you name it, and I just wanted to do that, you know, all the time, with cricket being the pinnacle. And he thrust under my nose an advert for the police force in Rhodesia, as it Zimbabwe then was.
He knew you so well.
Oh, bloody hell. How could I have seriously thought about that for even 10 seconds? But I did, and I responded to this and got a letter back, and only then did I realise, what am I doing?
Yeah, thank God you did.
Oh, thank...
What a different life that would have
been.
Oh,
my God. I don't think I'd be here. I don't think I'd be walking.
So, looking back to the guy that comes out of Bristol OVIC and that cohort and people you work with subsequently, you must know a hell of a lot of people who have given in to that urge to not be rejected anymore, to have a regular income and to have a career hierarchy or career progression. Have you been aware of that happening? Is it something, you know, you mentioned before we started taping about being at that age where friends and acquaintances are passing away, and but are you aware at any period, your 30s, 40s, 50s, when you started to think, God, all the people I trained with or worked with are starting to drop off in terms of professionally?
I think I was only aware of the people, well, obviously, I was only aware of the people I had contact with, and there were sort of three of the girls at drama school. Each year at Bristol had 20 men and 10 women, so three of the girls I was aware. Most dropped out, I mean, probably five or six dropped out straight away, you know, within a year or two.
Which is always a surprise. I'm always amazed at the numbers that drop out in year one.
Very quickly. And then, sort of later on, again, I suppose I'm thinking late 30s, early 40s, I was aware of two or three, who became psychotherapists. That seems to be a parallel course with acting. I remember principal at Bristol, Nat Brenner, saying, you don't go into... No, it was Rudy Shelley, one of the senior tutors there. Rudy Shelley, you don't go into acting to psychoanalyze yourself. Well, of course you do, don't you?
A bit
of you. That's absolutely what it's about, as is borne out by these girls' choice of career subsequently. Yeah.
And do you think, I mean, this is just taking that thread a little bit further, do you think there is a psychological impact to acting? Certainly, in your experience or people you've worked with, do you think it marks you psychologically in any way that you're aware of? That process of not just of rejection, but also of a rehearsal process, of investigating a character, of playing a character with conviction, of trying to empathize with other human beings from other backgrounds, different from your own.
Yeah, I don't know how much that sort of your personality and how much it is what you do. I guess the one feeds off the other. But yeah, that sort of empathy thing, you know. I find a lot of people that I know seem to be terribly certain about things, whereas I will always equivocate and see somebody else's point of view, you know. We'll see it as if it is, yeah, as if you are rehearsing characters. You know, well, what would I think in that situation? Or could this have happened? Or could that have happened? Or is there another way of seeing that? Oh, it might be said that he said that, but what if you didn't quite hear it? You know, whatever.
Questions.
Yeah.
We know all the good, well, we know some of the good things about being an actor from what you've discussed. What do you think is the best thing? What made you, as a guy in his 40s, who, you know, at the time you think must have been fairly close to giving up, what makes you stick with it? Why do you keep coming back?
Just that ambience of working with a cross-section of people, all of whom are required to take their defences down, and just sort of being with human beings with whom you're sort of sharing a very powerful story in rehearsal and then sharing it with an audience afterwards.
So this is kind of a question I normally ask much closer to the start, but on that basis, or on any basis, what's the show that stands out, if there's one, in memory that you think either I'm so proud of that, or that was magic? I mean, production rather than performance.
It's very hard because going back, I mean, I can remember shows at the Birmingham studio. We did Waiting for Godot twice. I played Vladimir. I played Estragon the first time, Vladimir the second time. It packed out. There were more people in the studio than there were in the main house. And it was just brilliantly funny and moving. I did, Endgame? Similarly, that was just a mind-boggling experience. I hadn't, because you must remember, I not being from a theatrical tradition, barely having been to the theatre, to suddenly find yourself stuck in the middle of these great works of art and making people laugh and moving people was just such an extraordinary experience. But latterly, I suppose there'd be two productions, the production of As You Like It at Sheffield and then came to the Lyric Hammersmith, which was just, the magic was just tangible. It was tremendous. And then a production of King Lear with Derek Jacobi, playing Kent in that. But again, it's over and above what you're playing and what you're doing in it, that sort of feeling of being part of some extraordinary event.
When you were coming out of Bristol Old Vic, you obviously had expectations about how your career may have, you know, revealed itself to you over the years. Looking back, do you think that 23-year-old would have been happy with how things have gone?
Do you mean career-wise or life-wise?
Career-wise.
I guess the two are completely entwined, aren't they? Your life and the career. You can't really separate them.
So?
I don't think I had any idea. I don't think I had the first idea. I can remember a session at drama school shortly before we left. A guy called Mike Osborne said it before I did, although the feeling was entirely mine. What do you most want to do when you leave the Old Vic School? And Mike said, I'd like to be in a Western. You know, lots of people said Hamlet and all of that. And he said, I'd like to be in a Western. And yeah, I'd still like to be in a Western.
Well, there you go. It's out there now. How do you define success?
I don't know. I suppose you could say making a living. That sounds pretty lame. Not really that. It's, how do you define success? God, how do you define success? Still to remain hungry. To remain hungry for what you've done. Based on what you've done, and still to want to do it. To still have the feeling. Therefore, to have achieved something to yourself, to have proved something to yourself, to have proved maybe what Nat said about how important theatre is, about how important it is for the community to engage in storytelling in that way, in pretending, in playing, to still be enamoured of that, to still want to do that, to still want to play.
If you could go back to that 23-year-old that you were yourself and offer him some advice based on what you've learned in the intervening years, what kind of things would you whisper in his ear?
Oh, these questions are so hard. Because you change, I was thinking this the other day, I said it to somebody, you change one thing, you know, do you regret? Another version of it is, do you regret anything from the, and yeah, I mean, there's loads of things, I should have done this, I should have done that, but overarching that is the sense that you change one thing, you change everything.
Yep.
And my life as a whole, you know, oh, this is going to sound so smug, but I wouldn't. I'm happy with where I am. I feel so lucky. I feel so privileged, so lucky, and still have this desire to go on playing with different groups of people. And yeah.
Have you ever been given advice by someone else, older or younger or contemporary? Any kind of advice you've picked up over the years and thought, yeah, that's worth hanging on to?
Yeah, my dad said something to me when I was at drama school. He said, if you're feeling low and down for any reason, I'll always give you the money to buy yourself a steak. If you're feeling down, low, for whatever reason, go and have a square meal. I'll pay for it. And I think that's about the best bit of advice.
Go and get a square meal.
Go and get a square meal, because the world looks a lot better when your belly's full.
Have you noticed many changes in the industry in the years that you've been working as a professional?
Well, you don't notice it. It's sort of incremental, isn't it? I mean, suddenly the repertory theatre system has disappeared. So it's changed beyond recognition.
Is that the big thing that, for you anyway, from your point of view as someone who's been through the rep, is that the thing that you would miss most if you were starting out again today?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you were starting out, you
wouldn't miss
it.
Yeah,
I'm incredibly glad that's that's special, that sort of... But then, you know, I mean, there's different special things now, I guess.
And a final bonus question. Are you in anything at the minute?
No.
And that's it for another episode of In Anything at the Minute, the Honest Actors podcast. That's number 10 out of the way, done and dusted. Thanks, as ever, to the interviewee. On this occasion, it was Michael Hadley, who, like all of the others up to now, has been extremely generous in terms of his honesty about his own career. So thank you, Michael. Thanks also to Equity, which was once again the venue for this week's episode. And thank you to everyone who's voted for the Honest Actors blog in the UK Blog Awards 2016. This is the last time I'm going to be able to mention the voting in the podcast itself, as the next episode, episode 11, will happen after voting has closed. So please, 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 if you haven't already, and even if you have, like I say, you can vote more than once, please go to the website inanything.com and click on the big blue Vote Now button. That's it from me, except to say stick around for an extract of an interview with me, which was done by Lewis Goody for his podcast, Acting Inspired. I think it's a really interesting project he's got going. I really recommend you take a look at it. It's on iTunes. Just search for Acting Inspired or go to actinginspired.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. Speak soon. Vote, vote, and vote again.